When the Jade Emperor opened Vesaravana's missive and saw that it contained an appeal for help, he said, laughing,
"This is preposterous. Am I to believe that a single monkey spirit is so powerful that 100,000 heavenly troops cannot deal with him? Vesaravana says that he must have help, but I don't know what troops he expects me to send."
Before he had finished speaking, Kuan Yin pressed together the palms of her hands and said, "Your Majesty need not worry. I know of a divinity who can certainly catch this monkey."
"Whom do you mean?" asked the Emperor.
"Your nephew, the magician Erlang," she said. "He lives at the mouth of the River of Libations, and there receives the incense that is burnt in the world below. In old days, he once overcame 6 ogres. He has his brothers with him, and 1,000 plant-headed deities of very great magical powers. Though he would not come if ordered to, he would listen to an appeal. If you send an appeal to him for troops, with his assistance, we could effect a capture." The demon king Mahabali was sent as messenger, and in less than half an hour, the cloud he rode on reached Erlang's temple. He came out with his brothers, and after burning incense, read the appeal.
"I let the heavenly messenger go back," he said, "and announce that I will help to the utmost of my power."
Then he called together his brothers and said,
"The Jade Emperor has just asked us to go to the Mountain of Flowers and Fruit and receive the submission of a troublesome monkey. Let's be off."
The brothers were elated, and they at once marshaled the divinities in their charge. The whole temple set out, falcon on wrist, or leading their dogs, bow in hand, carried by wild magic wind. In a trice, they had crossed the eastern ocean and reached the Mountain of Flowers and Fruit. Having announced their mission, they were led through the cordon and shown into the camp. They asked how matters stood.
"I shall certainly have to try a transformation,"
Erlang said.
"Keep the cordon closely drawn, but do not worry about what goes on overhead. If I am getting the worst of it, do not come to my assistance. My brothers will look after me. If I conquer him, do not try to bind him, but leave that to my brothers. All I ask is that Vesaravana should use an imp-reflecting mirror, standing with it halfway up the sky. If he tries to run away and hide, watch his reflection in the mirror, so that we don't lose sight of him."
The heavenly kings then took up their places, and Erlang and his brothers went out to give the challenge, telling their fellows to form a circle, keeping their falcons tethered and their dogs on leash. When he reached the door of the cave, Erlang found a host of monkeys drawn up in coiling dragon formation. In their midst was a banner with "The Great Sage Equal of Heaven" inscribed upon it.
"How dare that cursed monster call himself Equal of Heaven?"
snarled Erlang.
"Don't worry about that," said the brothers, "but go and challenge him at once."
When the small monkeys at the entrance to the camp saw Erlang coming, they scuttled inside and made their report. Monkey seized his metal-bound cudgel, donned his golden breastplate, put on his cloud-treading shoes and golden cap, and rushed out to the gate, glaring about him.
"What little captain are you, and where do you hail from?"
shouted Monkey.
"That you dare come here and challenge me to battle? Have you eyes with no eyeballs, that you fail to know me?"
shouted Erlang.
"I am the Jade Emperor's nephew. I have come now, by His Majesty's command, to arrest you, rebellious groom ape that you are. Your hour has come."
"I remember," said Monkey, "that some years ago the Emperor's sisters fell in love with a mortal of the world below, became his consort, and had a son by him, who is said to have split the Peach Mountain with his axe. Are you he? I am half minded to give you a bit of my mind, but you are not worth it. I should be sorry to strike you, for one blow of mine would be the end of you. Go back where you came from, little fellow, and tell the 4 kings of heaven to come instead."
Herr Lang was furious.
Keep a civil tongue in your head, he cried, and taste my blade.
Monkey dodged aside, and swiftly, raising his cudgel, struck in his turn. They closed over 300 times without reaching a decision. Ere Lang exerted all his magic power, shook himself hard, and changed into a giant figure 100,000 feet high. His two arms, each holding aloft a magic trident, were like the peaks that crown Mount Hua. His face was blue, and his teeth stuck far out. The hair on his head was scarlet, and his expression malignant beyond words. This terrible apparition advanced upon Monkey, aiming a blow straight down upon his head. But Monkey, also using his magic powers, changed himself into an exact counterpart of Erlang, save that he held above him a single gigantic cudgel like the solitary pillar that towers above Mount Kuan Lun. And with this, he fended off Er Lang's blow. But Monkey's generals were completely discomfited by the giant apparition, and their hands began to tremble so much that they could not wave their banners. His other officers were in panic and could not use their swords. At a word from the brothers, the plant-headed divinities rushed in, letting loose their falcons and dogs, and bow in hand, all charged into the fray. Alas! Monkey's four generals fled, and 2,000 or 3,000 of the creatures they commanded were captured. The monkeys threw down their weapons and rushed, screaming, some up the mountain, some into the cave. It was just as when a cat at night disturbs roosting birds, and their panic fills the starry sky. When Monkey saw his followers scatter, his heart fluttered. He abandoned his giant form and fled as fast as his feet could carry him. Erlang strode after him with huge steps, crying,
"Where are you off to? Come back this minute, and I will spare your life."
But Monkey fled faster than ever to his cave, where he ran straight into the brothers.
"Wretched Monkey, where are you running to?" they cried.
Monkey, trembling in every limb, hastily turned his cudgel into an embroidery needle, and hiding it about his person, changed himself into a fish, and slipped into the stream. Rushing down to the bank, Er Lang could see nothing of him.
"This simian," he said, "has certainly changed himself into a fish, and hidden under the water. I must change myself, too, if I am to catch him."
So he changed himself into a cormorant and skimmed hither and thither over the stream. Monkey, looking up out of the water, suddenly saw a bird hovering above. It was like a blue kite, but its plumage was not blue. It was like a heron, but had no tuft on its head. It was like a crane, but its feet were not red.
"I'll be bound that's Er Lang, looking for me."
He released a few bubbles and swam swiftly away.
"That fish letting bubbles," said Erlang to himself, "is like a carp, but its tail is not red. It's like a tench, but there are no patterns on its scales. It is like a blackfish, but there are no stars on its head. It is like a bream, but there are no bristles on its gills. Why did it make off like that when it saw me? I'll be bound it's Monkey, who has changed himself into a fish."
And swooping down, he opened his beak and snapped at him. Monkey whisked out the water and changed himself into a freckled bustard, standing all alone on the bank. Seeing that he had reached the lowest possible stage in transformation, for the freckled bustard is the lowest and most promiscuous of creatures, mating at hazard with any bird that comes its way, Erlang did not deign to close with him, but returned to his true form, and fetching his sling, shot a pellet that sent Monkey rolling. Taking advantage of his opportunity, Monkey rolled and rolled down the mountainside, and when he was out of sight, changed himself into a wayside shrine. His mouth wide open was the door opening. His teeth he turned into door flaps. His tongue into the guardian bodhisattva. His two eyes were the two round windows. He didn't quite know what to do with his tail, but sticking up straight behind, it looked like a flagpole.
When Erlang arrived at the bottom of the slope, he expected to find the bustard that he had toppled over, but instead he only found a small shrine. Examining it closely, he noticed the flagpole sticking up behind, and laughing, said,
"That's Monkey. That is, he's trying his tricks on me again. I've seen many shrines, but never one with a flagpole sticking up behind. No doubt about it. This animal is playing one of his games. He hopes to lure me up close to him, and then he will bite me. He won't get me that way. I'll clench my fist and bang in the windows first. Afterwards, I'll kick down the doors."
When Monkey heard this, he was horrified. "That's a bit too much," he said to himself. "The doors are my teeth, and the windows are my eyes. If he kicks my teeth and bangs my eyes, that won't be nice." So saying, he made a tiger spring and disappeared into the sky. Erlang was just getting tired of the vain pursuit when his brothers arrived.
"Well, have you called the great sage?"
they asked.
"He has just been trying to dodge me,"
said Erlang,
"by turning into a shrine. I was just going to hit his windows and kick down his doors when he suddenly disappeared. It's a queer business."
They all began peering helplessly about in every direction, but could find nothing.
"You stay here and keep a lookout,"
said Erlang,
"while I go up and search for him."
He mounted the clouds, and halfway up the sky came across Vesravana, who was holding the magic mirror, his son, at his side.
"Have you seen the Monkey King?"
he asked. "He's not been up here," said Vesravana. "I can see him in my mirror, you know." When Erlang had told him about the capture of the lesser monkeys and the great sage's repeated transformations, he added,
"Then he changed into a shrine, and when I hit at him, he suddenly disappeared."
Vesravana looked in his mirror and burst out laughing.
"Make haste, Erlang, make haste," he cried. "That monkey has made himself invisible, decamped, and made straight for your river of libations."
When Erlang heard this, he picked up his magic lance and fled towards the river of libation as fast as he could. Now, as soon as Monkey reached the river, he changed himself into the exact image of Erlang and went straight into Erlang's shrine. The guardian demons of the shrine could not tell the difference and bowed low as he came in. He examined the incense smoke and was looking at the votive paintings round the walls when someone came and announced,
"Another Erlang has arrived."
The guarding deities rushed out and could hardly believe their eyes.
"Has a creature calling himself the great sage, equal of heaven, been here?"
the real Erlang asked.
"We've seen nothing of any great sage," they said. "But there's another holy Erlang inside examining the incense smoke."
He rushed in, and as soon as Monkey saw him, he changed into his true form and said,
"Erlang, I don't mind telling you, the surname of that shrine was Sun."
Erlang raised his three-pronged, two-bladed magic lance and struck at Monkey's cheek. Monkey dodged, and the two of them, cursing and fighting, edged towards the shrine gate and out into the mists and clouds, struggling as they went, till at last Monkey was driven to the mountain of flowers and fruit where the kings of the four quarters were keeping straight guard. The brothers came to meet Erlang and surrounded Monkey, pressing about him on every side. Meanwhile, in heaven, everyone was wondering why a whole day had passed without any news from Erlang.
"Would your majesty," asked Kuan Yin, "permit me and the patriarch of Teo to go down in person and see how things are going on?"
"Not a bad idea," said the Jade Emperor,
and in the end he and the Queen of Heaven, as well as Kuan Yin and Liao Tzu, all went to the southern gate of heaven and looked out.
They saw the great cordon of heavenly troops, and Vaise Ravana standing halfway up the sky holding a mirror, while Erlang and his brothers pressed round Monkey, tussling fiercely with him.
That Erlang, whom I proposed, hasn't done so badly, said Kuan Yin. He has hemmed the great sage in, though he's not yet taken him prisoner. With a little help, I think he could manage it.
What weapon do you propose to use? How are you going to help him?
Asked Liu Zhu.
I shall throw my vase and willow spray down onto his head, said Kuan Yin. That won't kill him, but it will make him lose his balance, and Er Lang will easily be able to catch him.
Your vase, said Liu Zhu, is made of porcelain. If it fell in just the right place, it might be all right, but if it misses his head and falls on his iron cudgel, it will get broken. You had better leave him to me.
Have you got a weapon? Asked Kuan Yin.
I certainly have, said Liu Zhu,
and he produced from his sleeve a magic snare.
This, said he, is called the Diamond Snare. In old days, when I left China, converted the barbarians of the West, and became a god, I owed my success entirely to this snare. It comes in handy for keeping off all manner of dangers. Let me throw it down onto him.
Standing at the gate of heaven, he cast his snare, and it went rippling down straight onto Monkey's head. Monkey was busy warring with Erlang and his brothers, and did not notice that a weapon was falling upon him out of the sky. It hit him just on the crown of his head and toppled him over. He scrambled to his feet and fled, pursued by Erlang's dogs, who went for his calves, so that he stumbled again. Lying on the ground, he cursed, saying,
"This has done for me. Why can't you go and trip up your own master instead of coming and biting old Monkey's legs?"
He twisted and turned, but could not rise, for the brothers were holding him down. Soon they had bound him tightly with ropes and severed his lute bone with a knife, so that he could not transform himself. Liu Zhu drew in his snare and begged the emperor, Kuan Yin, the Queen of Heaven, and all the immortals to go back to the palace. On earth below, the kings of the Four Quarters and Vaise Ravana and all the heavenly host sheathed their swords and plucked up their palisades. Then they came up to Erlang and congratulated him, saying, "We owe this victory to you."
"Not at all," said Erlang. "It was entirely due to the founder of Teo and the gallant performance of the heavenly contingent. I can claim no credit at all."
"Elder brother," said the brothers of Erlang, "you have said enough. What we must do now is to hoist this fellow up to heaven and get a ruling from the Jade Emperor as to how he is to be disposed of."
"Brothers," said Erlang, "you are not on the roll of immortals and cannot appear before the emperor. Heavenly troops must be told to carry him up, and Vaise Ravana and I will go up and report. The rest of you had better search the mountain, and when you can report that all is clear, come to the River of Libations and let me know. Meanwhile, I will claim the reward due for my services and then come back to make merry with you."
The brothers bowed their assent. Erlang mounted the clouds, chanting songs of victory, and made his way to heaven. Here he sent in a message, saying,
"The great sage has been captured by the horse of heaven, and I have come to receive your instructions."
The Jade Emperor accordingly told the Demon King Mahavali and a contingent of heavenly troops to hoist Monkey up and bring him to the executioner's block, where he was to be cut into small pieces. If you do not know what now became of this Monkey King, listen to what is told in the next chapter. Monkey was brought to the place of execution, where heavenly soldiers bound him to a pillar and began to hew him with axes, stab him with spears, slash him with swords,
But all this had no effect whatever. And presently the southern pole star sent for the spirits of the fire stars to come and set him alight. But they were quite unable to burn him. The thunder spirits hurled thunderbolts at him. But this had even less effect. I don't know where the great sage got this trick of inviolability, said Mahabali to the Jade Emperor. Neither weapons nor thunderbolts have the least effect on him. What are we to do?
Yes, indeed, said the Jade Emperor. With a fellow like that, what line can one take? It is not surprising, said Liao Tzu. After all, he ate the peaches of immortality, drank the wine of heaven, and stole the elixir of long life. 5 bowls full, some raw, some cooked, are all inside him. No doubt he has worked on them with samadhi fire and fused them into a solid that makes his whole body harder than diamond, so that he is very difficult to damage. The best thing would be to bring him to me. I'll put him in my crucible of the 8 trigrams and smelt him with alchemic fire. In a little while he will be reduced to ashes, and I shall recover my elixir, which will be left at the bottom of the crucible.
So Nanke was handed over to Liao Tzu, and Erlang was rewarded with 100 golden flowers, 100 jars of heavenly wine, 100 grains of elixir, along with a great store of jewels, pearls, brocades, and embroideries, which he was asked to share with his brothers. He thanked the emperor and went back to the River of Libations. When Liao Tzu got back to the Tushita Palace, he untied Monkey's ropes, removed the blade that was stuck through his lute bone, pushed him into the crucible, and told his servant to blow up a good fire. Now this crucible was in 8 parts, each representing 1 of the 8 trigrams. Monkey wriggled into the part corresponding to the trigram Sun. Now Sun is wind, and wind blows out fire, but wind raises smoke, and Monkey's eyes smarted and became red, a condition from which he never recovered, which is why he is sometimes called Fiery Eyes. Time passed, and at last the 49th day came, and Liao Tzu's alchemical processes were complete. When he came to the crucible to take off the lid, Monkey was rubbing his eyes with both hands so hard that the tears fell. When he heard the lid being moved, he looked quickly up, and the light that came in hurt him so much that he could not bear it, and jumped straight out of the crucible, uttering a piercing cry and kicking over the crucible as he jumped. He rushed out of the room, pursued by Liao Tzu's servants, all of whom he tripped up. And when Liao Tzu clutched at him, he gave him such a push that he went head over heels. Then he took his cudgel from behind his ear and, armed once more, ran amok in heaven, frightening the 9 planets so much that they locked themselves in, and the kings of the 4 quarters vanished from the scene. This time Monkey hit out recklessly, not caring whom he struck or what he smashed. No one could stop him, and he would have broken up the hall of magic mists had not the divinity Wan Ling Quan rushed forward with his great metal lash.
"Halt, cursed monkey!" he cried. "See who stands before you, and cease your mad pranks!"
Monkey did not deign to parley with him, but raised his cudgel and struck. Ling Quan faced him with his whip aloft. It was a great fight that the two of them had in front of the Hall of Magic Mists, but neither gained the advantage. At last the 36 thunder deities came to Ling Quan's aid, and Monkey found himself beset on every side by swords, lances, spears, whips, axes, hooks, sickles. He thought it time to transform himself, and took on a form with 3 heads and 6 arms, and wielded 6 magic cudgels, which he whirled round like a spinning wheel, dancing in their midst. The thunder deities dared not approach him. The noise of the combat reached the jade emperor, who in great consternation sent two messengers to the western region to see if Buddha could not come and help. When they had recounted Monkey's misdeeds and explained their mission, Buddha said to the bodhisattvas who surrounded him, "You stay quietly here in the Hall of Law, and don't relax your yoga postures. I've got to go and deal with this creature who is making trouble at the Taoist court." But he called on his disciples Ananda and Kasyapa to follow him. Arriving in heaven, they heard a fearful din and found Monkey beset by the 36 deities. Buddha ordered the deities to lower arms and go back to their camp, and called Monkey to him. Monkey changed into his true form and shouted angrily,
"What bonds are you that you ask for me in the middle of a battle?"
"I am the Buddha of the Western Paradise. I have heard of the trouble you have been giving in heaven. Where do you come from, and how long ago did you get your illumination that you should dare behave like this?" So Monkey recited,
"Born of sky and earth, immortal, magically fused, from a mountain of flowers and fruit, an old monkey am I. In the cave of the water curtain, I ply my home trade. I found a friend and master who taught me the great secret. I have made myself perfect in many arts of immortality. I learned transformations without bound or end. I tired of the narrow scope afforded by the world of man. Nothing could content me but to live in the green jade heaven. Why should heaven's halls always have one master? In earthly dynasties, king succeeds king. The strong to the stronger must yield precedence and place. Hero is he alone who vies with powers supreme."
At which Buddha burst out laughing.
"Oh, after all," he said, "you are only a monkey spirit. How can you delude yourself into supposing that you can seize the jade emperor's throne? He has been perfecting himself for 1,750 kalpas, and every kalpa is 129,000 years. Just see how long it takes to achieve such wisdom as his. How can you, an animal who only in this incarnation received half-human form, dare make such a boast? You exceed yourself, and will surely come to a bad end.
Submit at once, and talk no more of your nonsense. Otherwise I shall have to deal sharply with you, and there won't be much left of the longevity you crave."
"He may have begun young," said Monkey, "but that's no reason why he should keep the throne forever. There is a proverb that says, 'This year, the Jade Emperor's turn. Next year, mine.' Tell him to clear out and make room for me. That's all I ask. If he won't, I shall go on like this, and they will never have any peace."
"What magic have you got," asked Buddha, "that would enable you to seize the blessed realms of heaven?"
"Many," said Monkey. "Apart from my 72 transformations, I can somersault through the clouds 108,000 leagues at a bound. Aren't I fit to be seated on the throne of heaven?"
"I'll have a wager with you," said Buddha.
"If you are really so clever, jump off the palm of my right hand. If you succeed, I'll tell the Jade Emperor to come and live with me in the Western Paradise, and you shall have his throne without more ado. But if you fail, you shall go back to earth and do penance there for many a kalpa before you come to me again with your talk."
"This Buddha," Monkey thought to himself, "is a perfect fool. I can jump 108,000 leagues, while his palm cannot be as much as 8 inches across. How could I fail to jump clear of it? You're sure you're in a position to do this for me?"
he asked. "Of course I am," said Buddha. He stretched out his right hand, which looked about the size of a lotus leaf. Monkey put his cudgel behind his ear and leapt with all his might.
"That's all right," he said to himself. "I'm right off it now."
He was whizzing so fast that he was almost invisible, and Buddha, watching him with the eye of wisdom, saw a mere
whirligig shoot along.
Monkey came at last to 5 pink pillars sticking up into the air.
This is the end of the world, said Monkey to himself. All I have got to do is to go back to Buddha and claim my forfeit. The throne is mine.
Wait a minute, he said presently. I better just leave a record of some kind in case I have trouble with Buddha. He plucked a hair and blew on it with magic breath, crying, Change! It changed at once into a writing brush charged with heavy ink, and at the base of the central pillar he wrote, The great sage equal of heaven reached this place.
Then to mark his disrespect, he relieved nature at the bottom of the first pillar and somersaulted back to where he had come from. Standing on Buddha's palm, he said,
Well, I've gone and come back. You can go and tell the Jade Emperor to hand over the palaces of heaven.
You stinking ape, said Buddha. You've been on the palm of my hand all the time.
You're quite mistaken,
said Monkey.
I got to the end of the world when I saw 5 flesh-coloured pillars sticking up into the sky. I wrote something on one of them. I'll take it there and show you, if you like.
No need for that, said Buddha. Just look down.
Monkey peered down with his fiery, steely eyes, and there at the base of the middle finger of Buddha's hand he saw written the words, The great sage equal of heaven reached this place. And from the fork between the thumb and first finger came a smell of monkey's urine. It took him some time to get over his astonishment. At last he said,
Impossible! Impossible! I wrote that on the pillar sticking up into the sky. How did it get on to Buddha's finger? He's practicing some magic upon me. Let me go back and look.
Dear monkey, he crouched and was just making ready to spring again when Buddha turned his head and pushed Monkey out at the western gate of heaven. As he did so, he changed his 5 fingers into the 5 elements, metal, wood, water, fire, and earth. They became a 5-peaked mountain named Wu Hissing Shan, Mountain of the 5 Elements, which pressed upon him heavily enough to hold him tight. The thunder spirits Ananda and Kasyapa all pressed the palms of their hands together and shouted, Bravo! Buddha, having thus quelled the baleful monkey, called to Ananda and Kasyapa to come back with him to the western heaven. Just as they were leaving, 2 messengers arrived from the hall of magic mists, saying, We beseech the Tathagata to wait a minute. Our master is on his way. Buddha turned his head, and a moment later saw a chariot drawn by 8 phoenixes covered by a canopy gleaming with jewels. There was a sound of many instruments and a chanting of innumerable spirit hosts. Flower petals fell through the air, and the smell of incense belched.
I am profoundly beholden to you for dealing with that monster, said the Jade Emperor, when his equipage drew up. And if you will consent to stay for a while, I will invite all the immortals to join us in a feast of thanks.
Buddha did not like to refuse. I could not do otherwise than come at your majesty's request, he said. What small success we have had is, however, not my work, but is entirely due to the founder of Teo and the other divinities.
The banquet was nearing its end when one of the heavenly detectives arrived, saying, The great sage is sticking out his head.
No matter, said Buddha,
and he took out of his sleeve a seal on which was engraved Om Mani Padme Hum. He gave it to Ananda and told him to stamp it on the top of the mountain. So Ananda left heaven, carrying the seal, and when he got to the mountain of the 5 elements, he stamped the seal hard upon a square slab of rock that lay right on top of the mountain. At once this mountain struck root and joined its seams. There was enough air to breathe, but not a crack through which hand or head could squeeze.
I have sealed him down, Ananda announced, whereupon Buddha said goodbye to the Jade Emperor and all the spirits, and with his two disciples left the gate of heaven. But in his mercy, he appointed a guardian spirit to watch over the mountain. When he is hungry, he said, give him an iron pill to eat. When he is thirsty, give him verdigris to drink. When the days of his penance are fulfilled, there will be one who will come to rescue him. And if you do not know how long afterwards, in what year, in what month, the time of his penance was fulfilled, you must listen to what is related in the next chapter. One day, when Buddha had been preaching to the Bodhisattvas and the Arhats, he said at the end of his sermon, I have been noticing there is a lot of difference in the inhabitants of the four continents of the universe. Those in the eastern continent are respectful, peaceable, and cheerful. Those of the northern are somewhat prone to take life. But they are so dumb, lethargic, and stupid, they don't do much harm. In our western continent, there is no greed or slaughter. We nurture our humours and hide our magic. And although we have no supreme illuminates, everyone is safe against the assaults of age. But in Drambadvipa, the southern continent, they are greedy, lustful, murderous, and quarrelsome. I wonder whether a knowledge of the true scriptures would not cause some improvement in them. Do you yourself possess their scriptures? Asked the Bodhisattvas. Yes, three baskets of them, said Buddha. One contains the Vinaya, which speaks of heaven, and one contains the Sastras, which tell of earth. One contains the Sutras, which save the damned. The whole is divided into 35 divisions written on 15,144 rolls. These are the path to perfection, the only gate to virtue. I would send it straight to the people of the common world, but they are so stupid, they would only jeer at the truth, misunderstand the meaning of my law, and scorn the true sect of yoga. I wish I knew of a holy one who would go to the eastern land and find a believer who would be sent over hill and dale all the way from China to this place. I would give him the scriptures to take back to China, and he would explain them to the people and change their hearts. That would be an untold blessing. Is any of you willing to go? Kuan Yin came up to the lotus platform, bowed three times to the Buddha and said, I don't know if I can make a success of it, but I should like to go to the eastern land and find someone to fetch the scriptures. You are just the person, said Buddha. A venerable Bodhisattva with great sanctity and magic powers. We couldn't do better. Have you any particular instructions? Asked Kuan Yin. I want you, said Buddha, to make a thorough study of the air at a fairly low altitude, not up among the stars. Keep an eye on the mountains and rivers, and make careful note of the distances and travelling stages, so that you may assist the scripture seeker. But it is going to be a very difficult journey for him, and I have 5 talismans which I should like you to give him. An embroidered cassock and a priest's staff with 9 rings were then fetched, and he said to Kuan Yin, when he feels his courage failing him on the road, let him put on this cassock. If he carries this staff, he will never meet with poison or violence. And here, Buddha continued, I have 3 fillets. They are all alike, but their use is different. Each has a separate spell. If on his journey the pilgrim meets with any ogre of superlative powers, you must attempt to convert this ogre and make him the scripture-seeker's disciple. If he resists, the pilgrim is to put 1 of these fillets on his head, reciting the spell that belongs to it, whereupon the ogre's eyes will swell and his head ache so excruciatingly that he will feel as if his brains were bursting, and he will be only too glad to embrace our faith. Kuan Yin bowed and called upon her disciple Hui Yin to follow her. He carried a great iron cudgel weighing 1,000 pounds and hovered round the bodhisattva, acting as her bodyguard. Kuan Yin made the cassock into a bundle and put it on his back. She took the fillets herself and held the 9-ringed staff in her hand. When they came to the weak waters which form the boundary of the river of sand, Kuan Yin said, "My disciple, this place is very difficult going. The scripture seeker will be a man of common mortal birth. How will he get across?"
"Tell me first," said Hui Yan, "how wide is the river of sands?"
The bodhisattva was examining the river when suddenly
there was a great splash, and out jumped the most hideous monster imaginable. Holding a staff in its hand, this creature made straight for the bodhisattva.
"Halt!"
cried Hui Yin, fending off the monster with his iron cudgel. And there, on the shore of the river of sands, a fearful combat began. Up and down the shore the battle moved, and they had fought 20 or 30 bouts without reaching a decision, when the monster halted with his iron cudgel held up in front of him and said,
"What priest are you, and where do you come from that you dare resist me?"
"I am Prince Moksha, second son of Vesravana, now called Hui Yin. I am now defending my superior on the journey to China, where we hope to find one who will come and fetch scriptures. What creature are you who dare bar our path?"
"Ah," said the monster, suddenly remembering, "didn't I used to see you in Kuan Yin's bamboo grove, practicing austerities? What have you done with the bodhisattva?"
"You didn't realize then that it was she on the bank?" asked Hui Yin. The creature was aghast. He lowered his weapon and allowed himself to be brought to Kuan Yin.
"Bodhisattva, forgive my crime,"
he cried, bowing profoundly.
"I am not the monster that I seem, but was a marshal of the hosts of heaven charged to wait upon the Jade Emperor when he rode in his phoenix chariot. But at a heavenly banquet I had the misfortune to break a crystal dish. By the Emperor's orders I received 800 lashes and was banished to the world below, transformed into my present hideous shape. He sends flying swords that stab my breast and sides one day in every 7. I get nothing to eat, and every few days hunger drives me to come out and look for some traveller on whose flesh I feed. Little did I think today that the traveller whom I was blindly attacking was none other than the bodhisattva."
"It was for sinning in heaven," said Kuan Yin, "that you were banished. Yet here you are adding sin to sin, slaying living creatures. I am on my way to China to look for a scripture seeker. Why don't you join our sect, reform your ways, become a disciple of the scripture seeker, and go with him to India to fetch the scriptures? I'll see to it that the flying swords stop piercing you. If the expedition is a success, you will have expiated your crime and be allowed to go back to your old employment in heaven. Doesn't that idea please you?"
"I would gladly embrace the faith," said the creature, "but there is something I must first confess. I have, since I came here, devoured countless human beings. Pilgrims have come this way several times, and I ate them all. The heads I threw into the river of flowing sands, and they sank to the bottom. Such is the nature of this river that not even a goose feather will float upon it. But there were 9 skulls that remained floating on the water and would not sink. Seeing that these skulls behaved so strangely, I moored them with a rope and in leisure moments drew them in and sported with them. If this is known, it seems likely that future pilgrims will not care to come this way, and my chances of salvation are lost."
"Not come this way? Nonsense," said the bodhisattva.
You can take the skulls and hang them round your neck. When the scripture seeker arrives, a good use will be found for them. The monster accordingly took his vows and was received into the faith, receiving the name of Sandy Priest. Having escorted Kuan Yin across the river, he went back and devoted himself to penances and purifications, never again taking life, but watching all the while for the pilgrim who was destined to come. So the Bodhisattva parted with him and went on with Hui Yen towards China. After a while they came to a high mountain from which there came an extremely bad smell. They had just decided to ride high over it on their clouds when there came a mad blast of wind, and there suddenly appeared before them a monster of hideous appearance. His lips curled and drooped like withered lotus leaves. His ears flapped like rushwork fans. He had tusks sharp as awls and a snout like the nozzle of a bellows. He rushed straight at Kuan Yin, striking at her with a muck rake. Hui Yen warded off the blow, crying, "Foul fiend, mend your manners and look out for my cudgel."
"This priest," cried the monster, "little knows what he's up against. Look out for my rake."
And at the foot of the mountain, the two of them had a great fight. Just when it was at its best, Kuan Yin, who was watching in the sky above, threw down some lotus flowers, which fell just between the cudgel and the rake.
"What sort of priest are you," the monster cried, "that you dare play upon me the trick of the flower in the eye?"
"Grovelling low-born monster," said Hui Yen, "I am a disciple of the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, and it was she who threw down these flowers. Didn't you recognize her?"
"You don't mean it,"
said he.
"The great Bodhisattva, the one that saves us from the three calamities and the eight disasters?"
"Whom else should I mean?" said Hui Yen. The monster dropped his rake and bowed low.
"Old chap," he said, "where is the Bodhisattva? I wish you'd introduce me."
Hui Yen looked up and pointed. "There she is, all right," he said. The monster kowtowed skyward, crying in a loud voice,
"Forgive me, Bodhisattva, forgive me."
Kuan Yin lowered her cloud and came up to him, saying,
"How dare a filthy old pig spirit like you attempt to bar my path?"
"I'm not really a pig at all,"
he said.
"I was a marshal of the hosts of heaven, but one day I got a bit drunk and misbehaved with the goddess of the moon. For this the Jade Emperor had me soundly thrashed and banished me to the world below. When the time came for my next incarnation, I lost my way and got by mistake into the belly of an old mother pig, which accounts for what I look like now. I spend my time eating people, that I own, but I never noticed it was you I'd run into. Save me! Save me!"
"There is a proverb," said the Bodhisattva, "which runs, works of damnation cannot lead to salvation. Having been banished from heaven because you broke its laws, you have not repented, but live on human flesh. Are you not inviting a double punishment for both your crimes?"
"Salvation indeed," cried the monster. "If I followed your advice, what should I live on? On the wind, I suppose. There is another proverb which says, if the government gets hold of you, they'll flog you to death. If the Buddhists get hold of you, they'll starve you to death. Go away. I see I should get on much better by catching a family of travellers now and then and eating their daughter, if she's buxom and tasty, no matter whether that's two crimes, three crimes, or 1,000 crimes."
"There is a saying," the Bodhisattva replied, "heaven helps those who mean well. If you give up your evil ways, you may be sure you won't lack nourishment. There are 5 crops in the world, so there is no need to starve. Why should you feed on human flesh?"
The monster was like one who wakes from a dream.
"I should like to reform,"
he said,
"but him no prayer can help who has sinned against heaven.
Here's a chance for you, said Kuan Yin. We are on our way to China to look for a seeker of scriptures. If you were to become his disciple and go with him to India, you would wipe out all your old sin.
I will! I will! Blurted out the creature.
All that remained now was to tonsure him and administer the vows, and it was agreed that he should be known in religion as Pigsy. He was told to fast, do penance, and keep all the while on the watch for the destined pilgrim. Proceeding on their way, Kuan Yin and Hui Yen were presently accosted by a dragon.
What dragon are you? Asked the Bodhisattva. And what have you done that you should be cast adrift here?
I am a son of the Dragon King of the Western Ocean, the dragon said. I inadvertently set fire to his palace. Some of his pearls of wisdom were burnt. My father insisted that I had done it on purpose and accused me in the courts of heaven of attempted rebellion. The Jade Emperor hung me up here in the sky, had me given 300 cuts of the lash, and in a few days I am to be executed. Can you do anything to help me?
Kuan Yin promptly went up to heaven, secured an interview with the Jade Emperor, and begged that the dragon might be forgiven, on condition that he allowed himself to be ridden upon by the pilgrim who was going to India to bring back the true scriptures. The request was granted, and the Bodhisattva ordered the little dragon to go down into a deep canyon and await the arrival of the pilgrim. It was then to change into a white horse and carry him to India. Kuan Yin and Hui Yen had not gone very far on their way to China when they suddenly saw great shafts of golden light and many wreaths of magic vapor.
That is the mountain of the five elements, said Hui Yen. I can see the imprint of Buddha's seal upon it.
Is not that the mountain, said Kuan Yin, under which is imprisoned the sage, equal of heaven, who upset the peach banquet and ran amok in the halls of heaven?
Very true, said Hui Yin. They alighted on the mountain and examined the seal, which was the six-syllable spell, Om Mani Padme Hum. Kuan Yin sighed a deep sigh and recited the following poem.
Long ago performed in vain prodigies of valor, in his blackness of heart he upset the heavenly peach banquet. In mad rashness he dared to rob the patriarch of Teo. 100,000 heavenly troops could not overcome him. He terrorized the realm of heaven throughout its 9 spheres. At last, in Buddha Tathagata, monkey met his match. Will he ever again be set at large to win back his renown?
Who is it? A voice came from inside the mountain. Who recites verses that tell of my misdoings?
Kuan Yin came down towards the place from which the voice seemed to come, and at the foot of a cliff found the guardian deities of the place, who, after welcoming the Bodhisattva, led her to where Monkey was imprisoned. He was penned in a kind of stone box, and though he could speak, he could not move hand or foot.
Monkey, cried the Bodhisattva, do you know me or not?
He peered through a chink with his steely, fiery eyes and cried aloud,
How should I not know you? You are she of Potalaka, the saviour Kuan Yin. To what do I owe this pleasure? Here, where days and years are one to me, no friend or acquaintance has ever come to seek me out. Where, pray, do you come from?
Buddha sent me, said she, to China to look for one who will come to India and fetch the scriptures, and as this place is on my way, I took the opportunity of calling upon you.
Buddha tricked me, said Monkey, and imprisoned me under this mountain 500 years ago, and here I have been ever since. I entreat you to use your powers to rescue me.
Your sins were very great, she said,
and I am by no means confident that if you get out, you would not at once get into trouble again.
No, said Monkey, I have repented, and now want only to embrace the faith and devote myself to good works.
Very well, then, said the Bodhisattva, delighted. Wait while I go to the land of Tiang, and find my scripture-seeker. He shall deliver you. You shall be his disciple, and embrace our faith.
With all my heart, said Monkey.
In that case, said Kuan Yin, you will have to have a name in religion.
I have got one,
said Monkey.
I am called Aware of Vacuity.
In that case, said Kuan Yin, there is nothing more I need tell you at present. I must be going. They left Monkey and went on eastwards. In a few days they reached the land of Tiang, and soon came to the city of Chang'an, where they changed themselves into shabby, wandering priests, and coming to the shrine of a local deity in one of the main streets, they went straight in. The deity and his attendant demons recognized Kuan Yin at once, despite her disguise, and welcomed her with a great flurry of bowings and scrapings. Then he sent word to the god of the municipal shrine, and all the temples in Chang'an, informing the gods that the Bodhisattva had arrived. Presently they all came tramping along, deigning to be excused for not having come to meet her.
This must not get out, she said. I am here completely incognito. I have come by Buddha's orders to look for someone to bring these scriptures from India. I should like to put up for a day or two in one of your temples, and as soon as I have found my pilgrim, I shall leave.
The gods then all retired to their temples, Kuan Yin and Hui Yen putting up for the time being in the shrine of the municipal god, where they passed for a couple of ordinary priests. If you do not know whom they found to fetch scriptures, you must listen to what is told in the next chapter. The great city of Chang'an had from generation to generation been the capital of all China. At this time, it was Tai Tsung of the dynasty of Tang who was on the throne. The whole land was at peace, tribute bearers poured in from every side, and the whole world paid homage to him. One day, when he was receiving all his ministers at court, the prime minister, Wei Qing, submitted the following proposal. Now that the empire is everywhere at peace, let us conform with the ancient custom and invite scholars from every quarter to come for examination, that your majesty may have talent to assist you in your work of government. The proposal was accepted, and a summons sent all over China invited any that were learned in books, no matter whether they were soldiers or peasants, to come to the capital and attend an examination. When the summons reached E Chou, a certain Qian O, who lived in those parts, went straight home and said to his mother,
"It is announced that an examination is to be held in order to pick out men of talent, and I intend to respond. One never knows. I may succeed in getting some little job or other, which will make me more of a credit to my parents and enable me to support a family. That is all I desire. I have come to tell you of my departure."
"My son," she said, "you are a well-read man. Learn when young, act when grown. You are quite right to go. All I beg is that you will take care of yourself on the journey and come back as soon as you have secured a post." Chen then ordered his servant to put together his things, and saying farewell to his mother, he hurried to the capital. When he arrived, he found that the examination had just begun, and he went straight in. He qualified in the preliminary tests, and at the final court examinations received the first place, the certificate being signed with the emperor's own hand. Then for 3 days, as the custom is, he was led through the streets on horseback. At one point, the procession passed the house of a minister called Yin Kai Shan. This minister had an only daughter called Wen Chiao, who was not yet married, and sat in a high festooned tower with an embroidered ball in her hand. The man whom this ball struck when she threw it down was to be her husband.
When Chain was led past the tower, she saw that he was a man of fine appearance, and she knew that he had just taken the first place in the examinations. The idea of marrying him pleased her uncommonly. She threw down her ball, and it fell exactly on the middle of Chain's black gauze hat. The next minute, Chain heard a twittering of flutes and reed organs, and down from the tower came a whole posse of maids and serving girls who took Chain's horse by the bridle and led him into the courtyard of the minister's house. The minister and his wife came hurrying down from the hall, calling upon their guests and visitors to assist in the wedding ceremony. When the bridal pair had bowed to heaven and earth and saluted the bride's parents, a banquet was prepared, and the whole night passed in merrymaking and drinking. Then, hand in hand, the two of them entered the bridal chamber. Early next morning, at audience in the Palace of Golden Bells, the emperor asked what post should be given to the first graduate. The Prime Minister replied there was a vacancy at Chiang Chu. Chain was accordingly made governor of Chiang Chu and ordered to take up his duties at once. Chain thanked the emperor and went back to the minister's house to arrange things with his wife and pay his respects to his parents-in-law. He then set out with his wife for Chiang Chu. It was late spring when he left the capital. A gentle wind fanned the green of the willows. A fine rain stabbed the red of the flowers. Chain's way took him close to Hei Chu, and here he was able to introduce his wife to his mother. "The power of your blessing," he explained to her, "enabled me to come out top in the examination. Being led through the streets on horseback, I happened to pass Minister Yin's house, from which an embroidered ball fell upon me, and I found myself invited to become his son-in-law. The emperor has made me governor of Chiang Chu, and I count upon you to come with us." His mother was delighted and set out with them at once. After travelling a few days, they reached the Inn of 10,000 Blossoms, which was kept by a certain Yu Hsieh. Here, the mother suddenly became unwell, and she said to her son, "I am not feeling well. Let us rest here for a day or two before going on." Chain consented. Next day, a man arrived at the inn with a golden-coloured carp for sale. Chain bought it for a string of cash, thinking it would make a wholesome dish for his mother. Suddenly he noticed that the fish's eyes flickered in a peculiar manner. "I have heard," he said, "that when the eyes of fish or snake flicker, one may be sure they are not ordinary creatures." He asked the man where the fish had come from.
"From the Hung River," said the man, "about 15 leagues from the town."
Chain accordingly had the fish put back alive into this river. When his mother heard of it, she thoroughly approved. "To release living things," she said, "is an act of piety. I am very glad you did it." "We have been here 3 days," said Chien, "and if I do not start out again at once, I shall not arrive by the appointed time. I think of starting tomorrow. Shall you be well enough then?" "I am afraid not," said his mother. "It is beginning to get very hot for travelling, and I fear I should get worse. Please arrange for me to have a room here. You can leave some of the luggage, and I will follow you when the weather is cooler."
So Chien hired a room for his mother, and he and his wife set off for Chiang Chu.
At the crossing over of the Hung River, they were met by 2 ferrymen called Liu and Lai, whom, so it happened, Chien had injured in a previous incarnation. When they were on board the boat, Liu began to stare at Chien's wife, who was indeed of matchless beauty. After whispering to Lai, he took the boat to a totally unfrequented spot, and at dead of night first killed the servants and next Chien himself, throwing all the bodies into the river. Seeing the fate of her husband, Mrs. Chien tried to jump into the river, but Liu threw his arms about her and stopped her, saying, Come with me, and everything will be all right. If you refuse, the same sword will serve well enough for both.
Jane's wife could think of nothing better to do than to give in for the time being, and she told Lou to do with her as he would. He took the boat across to the other shore, where he left it in charge of Lai, while he himself purloined Chien's official robes, hat, and credentials. Then, with Mrs. Chien, he set out for Chiangchu. The other bodies floated downstream, but Chien's sank straight to the bottom and stayed there. A yaksha that was patrolling the waters saw it, and rushing off to the Dragon King's palace, announced that an unknown body, apparently that of a scholar, had been thrown into the river and was lying at the bottom. The Dragon King ordered the body to be brought to him, and at once recognized it as that of his benefactor.
"One good deed deserves another," he said. "I must get his life back in return for his kindness the other day."
So he sent a yaksha to the municipal shrine at Hung Chau to ask for Chien's soul. The god of the shrine soon found it among those of the newly dead, and he gave it to a little demon to hand over to the yaksha, who brought it back to the Dragon King in his palace.
"Now," said the Dragon King, "perhaps you wouldn't mind telling me your name and where you come from."
When Chien had told his story, the Dragon King said to him,
"It will surprise you to learn that the golden carp, which you put back in the water, was I myself. Thus you are my benefactor, and it was only natural that when you got into difficulties I came to your assistance. For the present, I am going to ask you to serve in my water bureau as an officer."
Chien bowed his thanks and consent, and presently was entertained to dinner by the Dragon Court. Mrs. Chien was so disgusted by the presence of Liu that she could neither eat nor sleep, but she remembered that she was going to have a child, and there was nothing for it but to keep going as best she could and follow her captor. At last they reached Chiangchu, where they were met by all the clerks and lictors, and Liu, posing as the new governor, was entertained by his subordinates at the great official banquet.
"My arrival here is due solely to your flattering support."
"Oh, not at all," they said. "Your entertainment is, on the contrary, the due reward of your exceptional talents, your parental kindness towards those who are in your charge, and your fairness in settling litigation. Pray do not be too modest." One day, when the counterfeit governor had gone on official business to a place some way from the city, his wife sat in her high bower, thinking sadly of her mother and her husband. Suddenly a great lassitude seized her. Together with sharp pains in her belly, she fell into a swoon upon the floor and gave birth, there and then, to a son. At this moment a mysterious voice whispered in her ear, "Listen to what I am telling you. I am the Lord of the Southern Pole Star. It was by command of the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin that I brought you this child. One day he will be famous throughout the world. Be sure that he is no common mortal. When Liu comes back, he will certainly try to harm this child. You must guard it with all your might. The Dragon King has your husband in his care, and in due time you are to be reunited, you, he, and the child, and in due time your enemies will be punished." When she came to herself, the visitant had departed, but she remembered every word. She clasped the child in her arms, but could think of no further way to protect it. As soon as Liu came back and saw the child, he ordered it to be slain. She objected that it was now too late in the day, but promised to throw it into the river early in the morning. Fortunately, Liu was called away again on urgent business early next day.
if he finds it here when he comes back, she said to herself, he will certainly destroy it. I had better go at once and abandon it in the river on the chance that some miracle may save it. Then she bit off the top joint of the little toe of its left foot, that there might be no mistake about its identity. She took her inner garment, wrapped it round the child, and when no one was looking, slipped out with it into the street. Luckily, the river was not far off. When she reached the river, she gave one long, piercing cry, and was just about to throw it in, when she saw a plank come floating along by the bank. Lifting her head and praying to heaven, she tied the child to the plank with her sash, the blood letter at its breast, and pushed the plank out into the river to float where it would. Then, weeping bitterly, she returned to the town. Meanwhile, the plank floated downstream and eventually came to a standstill just opposite the Temple of the Golden Mountain. The abbot of this temple was called Fa Ming, and was a man of great sanctity. He was sitting in meditation when he suddenly heard the sound of a baby crying, and moved to pity, he went down to the river bank. What should he see but a plank with an infant tied to it, lodged against the bank of the stream? He fished the plank out, and at once saw the letter which acquainted him with the child's origin. He named it River Float, and gave it to some peasants to bring up, himself keeping the letter safely locked away. Years slipped by, and when River Float was 17, the abbot had him shaved and admitted into the priesthood with the name Hsuan Tsang. And Hsuan Tsang applied himself with great industry to the study of the way. One spring day, when the priests were discussing abstract points of doctrine in the shade of some pine trees, a doltish priest, who had been downed in argument by Hsuan Tsang, lost his temper and cried, "Who are you to lay down the law to us, you miserable animal? No one knows who you are, who were your parents, or where you came from." Stung by this insult, Hsuan Tsang rushed to the abbot with tears in his eyes and said,
"You have taught me that all human beings receive their portion of yin and yang and their share of the five elements from a male and female parent. Can there be such a thing in the world as a man without father and mother?"
"If you indeed wish to seek your true parents," said the abbot, "follow me to my cell."
Hsuan Tsang followed him, and from a hiding place above the beam, the abbot took down a small box, opened it, and took a letter written in blood and a woman's shirt, which he gave to Hsuan Tsang, who read the letter, and knew at last the names of his parents and the wrong that had been done to them. He who fails to avenge the wrongs done to a parent is unworthy of the name of man, said Hsuan Tsang. Let me go and find my mother, and I swear that afterwards, with an incense bowl upon my head, I will rebuild this temple to repay your reverence for all you have done for me.
If you are determined to go, said the abbot, take this letter and shirt with you. Travel in the guise of a mendicant priest, and when you get to Chiang Chu, go straight to the chancellery and demand to see your mother.
It happened that when Hsuan Tsang arrived, Liu was again absent on business, for heaven wished mother and child to meet. Hsuan Tsang went straight to the door and begged for alms. Now it also happened that his mother had dreamt that night of a waning moon becoming full again. She thought to herself, "Of my child I have no news. My husband was slain, and my child I threw into the river. If by chance he was rescued and cared for, he must by now be 17. Perhaps today heaven will cause us to be reunited. Who can tell?"
Suddenly she heard someone at the gate reciting the scriptures and begging for alms. She went out and asked him where he came from. When he said he came from the Golden Mountain, she bade him come in and gave him some rice. "Do you know, you're very like my husband," she said, looking at him closely. Then, dismissing her maid, she asked, "Little priest, were you admitted to the order in childhood, or when you grew up? What is your name, and who were your parents?"
"To tell the truth," said Xuan Zang, "I have a wrong to avenge, great as heaven, an enmity deep as the sea. My father, the abbot Fa Ming, told me to come here and find my mother."
"What is your mother's surname?"
she asked.
"It is Yin," he said, "and her name is Wen Chiao. My father's surname is Qian. I am called River Float, and my name in religion is Xuan Zang."
"I am Wen Chiao," she said.
"But have you any proof of what you are?" At this he flung himself upon his knees and said, sobbing,
"Mother, if you do not believe me, here is a letter written in blood and a shirt as proof."
She recognized them at once, and they embraced, weeping. Suddenly she cried,
"Leave me, leave me."
"What? After being parted for 17 years, must we separate again so soon?"
"Go quick as lightning," she said. "If Liu comes back and finds you here, he will strike you dead on the spot. Tomorrow I will pretend that I am unwell, and that I once made a vow to give 100 pairs of slippers as alms. I will come to your temple to fulfill the vow. Then we can talk."
Next day she lay on her bed, refusing food and drink. When Liu questioned her, she said,
"I once made a vow to give 100 pairs of shoes as alms. 5 nights ago I dreamt that a priest holding a sword in his hand came to claim the shoes. Since then I have felt ill."
"Oh, that can easily be settled," he said. "I wish you had told me before."
He went to his stewards and told them to get 100 peasant families of the neighbourhood, each to plait a pair of straw shoes and send them in within 5 days. When this had been done and the shoes duly received, she asked Liu what temples there were in the neighbourhood where she could fulfil her vow.
"The Golden Mountain Temple and the Burnt Mountain Temple," he said. "Neither would do."
"I have often heard that the Golden Mountain Temple is well worth a visit," she said. "I think I will go there." Liu ordered his servants to make ready a boat, and with some confidential maids, she went on board and was brought to the Golden Mountain. When the maids came up to the temple and announced that their lady had come to fulfil a vow, all the priests came out to welcome the visitor. After paying her respects to the image of the Bodhisattva and distributing small alms, she told her maids to put the shoes in a basket and bring them to the hall, while she burned heart incense and prayed. Then she asked the abbot to tell all the priests to withdraw, and kneeling in front of Xuan Zang, she drew the shoe and sock from his left foot. Sure enough, the top joint of his little toe was missing. Mother and son then embraced again, and she thanked the abbot for all his kindness to her child.
"Now that you have met," said the abbot, "the safest thing for you, madam, would be to go home at once, so as not to arouse the suspicions of your captor."
Wen Chiao agreed, and gave an incense ring to Xuan Zang, telling him to take it to the Inn of the 100,000 Blossoms, where his grandmother had been left behind.
"I will give you a letter," she said, "which you will take to the king's capital, to the house of the minister Ying Kaishan, which is just to the left of the Golden Hall. Give the letter to my father, and tell him to ask the emperor to send horses and men to Qian Chu, that the impostor may be taken and executed, your father avenged, and I myself rescued from his clutches. For the present I dare not stay any longer, or he will be wondering why I have been away so long."
When Hsuan Tsang reached the Inn of 10,000 Blossoms, he asked the landlord what had become of the lady who had been left there some time ago by a traveller called Qian.
"Yes," he said, "she was here for a long time, but she went blind, and for several years wasn't able to pay for her room. In the end, she went to live in a derelict potter's kiln near the southern gate, and she picks up a living by begging in the streets. It's a very strange thing that the gentleman who left her should have disappeared like this for years on end without a word of news."
Hsuan Tsang succeeded in finding the old lady.
"Your voice," she said, "is very like that of my son, Qian O."
"I am not Qian O, but I am his son, and Wen Cheo is my mother."
"When, why did your father and mother not come too?" she asked.
"My father," he said, "was killed by a bandit who forced my mother to be his wife. I have a letter of hers here, and an incense ring."
"Alas," cried the old woman, "that I should ever have thought my son had cruelly abandoned me. Little did I think that he had been done to death. Heaven, however, has taken pity on me and continued our line, so that at last our grandson has come to seek me out."
He took her back to the inn, paid what was owing, and hired her a room. Then, promising to be back in a few weeks, he set off for the capital and soon found the minister Yin's house. "I am a relation of your master's," he said to the porter, "and I should like to see him."